Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's most well-read podcast network. Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George Dimerelis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, she is a citizen of the world, born in Egypt, raised in Kuwait. She's worked in the United Arab Emirates, but since then has moved on to get a master's and a PhD in, is it marketing is like broad enough?
I would say marketing, consumer behavior, that sort of a line of research, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Auckland, where you were, but now you've moved over to Melbourne, working in RMIT. Dr. Marianne McCarr.
You said it right. It's all good.
Okay, right. How you doing? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, George.
I've really stumbled. I think I got most of that in there. I do actually have a list here of everything that's involved, because some of it I find really interesting, the luxury consumption and stuff.
Yeah.
Firstly, a bit about you. Yes, yeah, so you've been... You're a citizen of the world.
I do. I feel like that. I'm a chameleon, and I feel like I can belong anywhere, anytime, any place. Mm-hmm. Probably it's because of where I was raised in Kuwait. You know, it's such a melting pot. Like, you don't have Kuwaitis. They're not the majority. The majority are actually all the expats. So that's kind of my upbringing.
Right. Yeah. And is that expats like... of other states around there, or is it from...
No, everywhere. From Ghana, from Azerbaijan, from Egypt, from Lebanon, from the UK, states, everywhere.
Okay.
And it's probably because of the school I went to. It was an international school. And I know that a lot of people would, you know, recognize that because, like, in Singapore, in Qatar, in Bahrain... It's the same. We all sound the same.
Yeah, I know. It's
yet we
funny.
Look weirdly different. So.
Yeah, no, it's funny because you'll have like almost a kind of American accent.
Yeah,
but not quite. Yeah,
I think I don't. When people say, "Are you from America or are you from Canada?" I'm like, "No, I'm international," and that's an international accent.
It is, yeah,
so
no,
yeah,
it's got like its basis there,
yes.
But it's a bit different.
Yeah.
All right. So when did you move to Kuwait?
I was born in Kuwait.
Oh, you were born in Kuwait?
So, yeah.
I thought you were born in Egypt, that's right.
No, I'm. My parents are Egyptian, but I was born in Kuwait.
Okay.
My brothers as well. We were raised in Kuwait until I graduated high school, and then I went to Egypt for my undergrad to an American university over there.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
And was that like, did you always... So, they speak... Okay, this is going to sound like very dumb. I should
it's
know
okay.
this already, but like in terms of... speaking a language, is it a similar language, Kuwait and Egypt?
No, so it's a dialect.
Yeah.
Egyptian would be a dialect. It's Arabic. We all speak Arabic.
All speak, yeah.
The beauty of it all is that as an Egyptian, everyone watches Egyptian movies. So it's
I've heard that, yeah.
So everyone, you know, understands what we're saying. It can be hard, like, to understand their dialect sometimes. But if you grew up there, you're very much. Used to their accent and used to the dialect and words that they say and, you know, their narrative and things like that. So,
right. Yeah, and I've got a friend of mine, he's Lebanese, but his mom's always watching the Egyptian soapies.
There you go. It's how it is.
Yeah.
Till this day, by the way.
Yeah, it's still going now. That's So your connection with Egypt was still pretty strong growing up, like even though you were in Kuwait?
Yes and no, because simply my... So when I go back to Egypt during summer holidays, I would every year.
Okay.
But I always looked and sounded different than the common Egyptian, simply because I just didn't fit anywhere. That's another thing. Like, I fit everywhere and nowhere.
That's how you feel?
I always felt, until this day, I always feel that way. It's like a liminal kind of space that I live in. And it's just me and my family, and that's it. I mean,
is it like, wouldn't that be pretty, especially from international, because you went to an international school, it'd be fairly common background for all of them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, we felt like we belonged. Like, if I meet someone here in Australia who's grown up in the Middle East, like in the Gulf specifically, we feel a connection. There is like an imagined community that we feel we're part of, you know? But we're a minority. There aren't many people like us. The majority would have either grown up in Egypt and come here, or like grown up in their country, which is, you know, it's the normal. Majority. Yeah, it's normal. We're not normal.
Yeah. Okay. So just to jump ahead though. So are you married to someone who's also from that background, or just?
So my husband was born in Egypt, but he was raised in Saudi Arabia and Nigeria. So we're both we're similar in that sense that, you know, he sounds like me as well. We look alike and we sound alike, but we're not related, just so you know.
You've had to deal with that before.
No. We share a lot of, our backgrounds are the same.
Yeah. Okay, at least in terms of, well, yeah, got the Egyptian background, but then obviously just the international experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Kuwait, you studied in Egypt, and then you worked in the UAE.
Yeah, so when we got married and we moved to the UAE, to Dubai, worked there. I worked in public relations and marketing, at, you know, working with luxury brands like Land Rover, Jaguar. And when I worked in marketing, I was marketing manager for Alfred Dunhill, which is a menswear, leather goods kind of brand, British brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's...
Right. So did you fall, like, I'm guessing you studied just broadly marketing rather than specifically luxury marketing, or was it?
Yeah, I studied mass communications, integrated marketing communications. So specifically, but I did study public relations and, you know, that sort of thing. And that's kind of what brought me into public relations first in an agency. And that's when I realized it's a tough industry. I better go to a brand, a client.
Just tough as in for the culture?
You're working 24/7. You're on call all the time. It's a demanding job. It's a fun job, don't get me wrong. You work with amazing brands. You get this beautiful portfolio of excellent brands and people you work with, and you're doing exciting things like events, you're writing press releases, all that cool stuff. But it can get to you, especially when you're working with, like me, I was working with 8 brands at one time, and that can be very demanding.
Yeah. So I feel like, so public relations in separately to marketing, because I guess marketing is different. So public I feel like you might get a bad rap, because most of the time you're going to hear public relations is when people are like, we need to do public relations on this quickly.
Yeah, it's always a crisis, crisis management, yeah.
But is that what it actually is, or is it?
No, actually, majority of my work was always really introducing products or sending out testers to journalists to get them to review it. Back then, in the early 2000s, we didn't have a lot of YouTubers and influencers. That wasn't there at that time. It was more journalists and magazine editors and things like that.
So much easier.
It was a lot easier to manage. I feel
you got
for
like 10 names. You could be like, all right, I know the.
Well, it was more than 10, okay, but yes.
Now it's just completely insane. Like,
it's insane. Yeah, it's insane right now.
Yeah, because it's just everything segmented so much to the point where like nothing. The other, so to go back to the luxury brand thing, I'm so interested in that, because like obviously like so higher tier brands, does that mean there's a different marketing strategy to like mid tier brands, I guess, or whatever? Or is it kind of the same? Just
It's absolutely. Look, you do a lot of things differently. Your promotions plan is very different when you're working with, say, Cartier, for example, than if you're working with a skincare brand like Beiersdorf Nivea, right? You don't, with Nivea, you would be doing a lot of, you know, TV promotions and above the line, below the line campaigns,
What does that mean again?
Above the line would be things like you would see like outdoor ads and things like that. Below the line would be things like in-store stuff, you know?
Okay, right.
But in general, it's more, with luxury brands, you'd be doing a lot of niche, classy kind of promotions. It wouldn't be actual promotions like discounts. It would be more a large billboard versus a TV ad. You will never see Cartier having a TV ad per se. You would see the more large billboards, in-store work that they would do, like the window displays. They spend a lot on window displays, more working with the customer experience. And that would be, you spend a lot of time with the, you know, with the customers, creating events for them, your VIP customers as well. While Nivea, for example, you'd be doing a lot of press, but you'd be doing a lot of advertising around it.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
It's and a totally different.
Yeah, because it's like one, you almost want to make it a bit more exclusive.
Exactly.
Like the vibe. And yeah. It's like, ugh, TV, how cheap.
I mean, yeah, in a way, because with TV, you can't control. I mean, you the media buyer who works for the brand could control, you know, which TV, which channel they focus on, what's the best schedule, what time of the day. But in essence, you can have an ad, let's say if it was Cartier, for example. I'm always bringing Cartier, although...
It's the easy one. Everyone's like, oh, that's lucky.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. You can have Cartier and then right after it, a Coca-Cola brand. There's a lot of research around the proximity of brands to each other. It's the same when you're in a store, for example, in a mall. You would never see Cartier right next to a lower-tiered brand. You would see it next to all the luxury brands. Mm. It's the image. It's what it signals. It's that aura, you know, the vibe that you're trying to say about your product.
Actually, with that as well, so with has there been a change in, like, I always think of this, obviously, and this is actually a cultural analysis as well.
Yeah.
But with the rise in Asia of so much money there, obviously that became like a focus for luxury brands as well. Yeah. And from my understanding, actually it was a case where like that's where all their money was being made basically. So in comparatively, like they were just cleaning up in like places like China and stuff.
Yeah.
Did that like change the way they kind of operated, the way they branded things and all that? Like was there,
absolutely.
And is there a pushback against it as well? Is it like we don't want to be getting bought too much by anyone or like?
No. With advertising and all that, obviously, and the products and redesigning. Yeah. I mean, if you look today at Alfred Dunhill's menswear, and I still keep track because I still love the brand, mm-hmm. right? It's become a lot inconspicuous, a lot more inconspicuous. It's very suitable to the Asian consumer, but also to the inconspicuous male masculine connoisseur.
Right.
Right. So it's not really steering away from their product or from the brand's image and the positioning, but it really tailors to that target audience. And look at the models that are featured in ads and all these things. It's changed. And it has to,
more international,
right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely. Yeah, I just find it interesting because, like, I don't know, there's a friend of mine has mentioned it. There is a large section of tacky rich that exists now, maybe, where it's like huge brand. They want people to know what they're wearing almost. So, because you always, like, when I travel, I see it sometimes. I'm like, look at who would want a t-shirt that says Yves Saint Laurent, like just plastered across it? It's like, this isn't about looking good. This is about showing everyone that you're wearing that.
Exactly.
And I just wonder how much that impacts the brands as well, being like, these people want to everyone to know that it's this brand or whatever.
Yeah. But there is a group of, not nouveau riche, I would say the rich Chinese or Korean or Taiwanese, whatever, that actually they prefer the inconspicuous consumption and they prefer inconspicuous brands that has lower signaling. In fact, because of my work with Dunhill, that's what led me to doing my master's research, which was on inconspicuous consumption.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So it's about like looking... Okay, so that's interesting. Okay, so so basically where people, it's subtle that you're spending
subtlety,
that kind of money. So other people I guess the idea is that people who have a certain refined taste will appreciate what you've got, but everyone else won't know.
Exactly. That kind of you are signaling something when you don't have a logo or very inconspicuous, let's say a Bottega Veneta. if you know this bag and you're very educated, you have the information, you're very classy, you come from a well-to-do family, taste-wise as well, taste regime is in that sense, you can identify that Bottega Veneta. So you and I will become closer in that sense. Mm. You understand me, I understand you, and I want to be affiliated with someone like you. While someone else who is Novorish, meaning newly rich and is trying to reach that, you know, top-tiered customer, that type of person that's aspirational to them, they think that by wearing a Louis Vuitton bag plastered with LV, 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 or Yves Saint Laurent, for example, that that's their way of entering that new segment.
Yeah. It's interesting because, yeah, like, I guess that's the difference between, like, I just haven't thought about it. It's like some people might just want to show off that they've got money. But once you have money, I guess a lot of them want to show off that they've got taste almost. Like that's
but that taste is really difficult to get. And it takes time.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. That's like, as in,
that's the next level.
Anyone can throw money around essentially once you have it. But yeah, like, to have the taste that requires, it's like almost, I guess, a history of money. Like,
yeah,
you're not nouveau riche if you got like
exactly
if you've grown up knowing what style is and stuff.
Yeah,
so.
But it's not hard to get to that point. Like, I mean, it does take time. But if a person is committed, so say they came from a lower class background, they climbed the ladder, they can now afford the big car, the bit, you know, the three B's basically, the batch, the boat, the car, the house, the, you know, it's that.
I didn't know that. I've heard that before, but
cool. Oh, really?
Yeah.
But if you can afford all that, now is the time that you actually start learning. Now, if you're young, you can learn all these things from social media influencers, right? They're teaching you the taste. Wear this with that. Don't do that. Don't go to that place. That's where the top-tiered people go, you know, the best luxury customer.
Mm.
And so you can learn. It's now more, there are less barriers to get to that point.
Yeah, now
the internet allows that. Easy.
Yeah. Now, and again, this probably goes back to the whole segmentation thing. Now it's almost like not just being classy, now you've got to find your own style within that,
yeah,
which is like good.
Yeah.
Kind of. Like, it's,
there's something else as well. I mean, secondhand shops. Right? The op shops, all these things, they have people who want to get rid of their goods. They would put that there. You can't afford luxury. Now it's affordable because now I can buy those inconspicuous. Sometimes I don't even know if it's a very luxury product. If you're not that knowledgeable, you know, in brands, it's now very easy to get to those things. It's very easy to present yourself in that way.
Mm.
Rental, you know, the sharing economy allows for that, and the circular economy allows for that.
It's interesting. So, like, what's going to happen now to make, because obviously the goal of the people with money is to establish that they, is to subtly let everyone know that they have it, and the more subtle, but like the more distinct they have to be. So, like, what do you do when everyone gets better and better at faking it, I guess is a way of saying it, but like,
how do you
show your status, I guess.
Now it's harder, you know, it's, but again, there are two types of that luxury consumer. There is the one who doesn't give a shit, you know, doesn't care. But then there's the one that really, I want to separate myself from that type of consumer. Mm. So it could be, let me become more sustainable. That's the new trend, right? That's the new fad. I'm going to drive a Tesla. I'm going to wear recycled clothes. There's always something.
Yeah, well,
right?
That's what I mean, right? Yeah. That's kind of what I was like. I was wondering whether that was something that happened maybe is in a response to obviously a lot of money that's been going in, and maybe with Asia rising up, a lot of the people in other cultures are like, we want to look more subtle about it. So maybe we'll actually go back to more natural stuff. And obviously, I mean,
we can't correlate. We can't make that connection. But, you know,
because just think of like the rise of like the whole Byron Bay thing, like that whole concept of like getting back to nature, like all those people are stupidly loaded now and they're flashing in a completely different way, kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if that's, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm just in nature. Yes, I'm in a trust fund and I've got hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, but
I'm natural.
Yeah, but I'm natural. Know? Yeah. I mean, I'm only wearing cloth that my friend knitted for me. It's like they've gone full back.
Yeah, to that natural, you know, early days state. What's going to be next? You know, if that fad goes away, Who knows? You know?
Yeah, who knows?
That's Let's wear trash bags. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Hope it goes that way.
One with trash.
Cool. Now we should get started on the book. This is, it's funny, we've had a very different discussion to what the book is.
Well, it's not too far off.
Really?
Luxury.
Okay, that's
they
true,
are
actually.
Royals,
yeah.
Right?
So, okay, so let's. So your book of choice for today is?
It's called Desert Royal by Jean Sasson. Mm-hmm. It's about royalty in Saudi Arabia and specifically female royalty, princesses, all these things, and how their lives are really all about. We often think, if you're a princess, you have a golden spoon always, you know, handed to you, the car, the clothes. But actually, these women live in a lot more impoverished lives than we think. And they may be rich, but they're not free. Mm. And it goes with my interest on, obviously, women's lives, how women are brought up, how they're raised in a very patriarchal kind of society, right? Maybe it has.
You mean everywhere, or specifically in
in Saudi Arabia? Yes. But let's face it, in the Gulf, in my own country, if people follow the news, there's every day a woman's been raped, murdered, sexually harassed. That's quite a profound kind of experience if you've lived in this part of the world. I'm not saying don't go, please don't get me wrong, but the reality is these women, there are these issues and they still exist. They're probably hidden and they are hidden. But these days, you know, women are like these royalty, whether in Dubai, you know, in the United Arab Emirates or Kuwait, or women are being are able to escape. Not all of them, but when they escape, they have to live in exile, and they have to live in hiding. Actually, most of the time, and it's the plight of women in the Middle East that really interests me.
Right, and so this story is fictional, but is it based on something that's actually?
It's not fictional.
Oh, it's not fictional.
The names are changed. Some changes have taken, like they have changed some stories so that this princess isn't identified. She still lives in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a combination of like based on all this stuff, but not actually. Okay.
Yeah.
So
Jean Sasson published a series on this specific princess, right? And her name is not real. Sultana is not her real name. There's another.
That's why I saw a trilogy. I'm like, surely this is like, it must be a combination of things. I don't
know.
It's
about how she grew up in a family with her brothers. And then afterwards, how her, you know, how when she got married, how her daughters, their experiences, and so on. And there's another book called Maya that's about an Iraqi. It's not just about the princess, but it's about generally women's lives and how they're treated or mistreated. Actually, best to say, how they're mistreated in whether in their families with that patriarchal kind of idea of the male dominant and then everyone else.
Yeah. And I mean, like, so there's a lot to talk about with what you just said. Yeah. So I guess, I don't know, how much of this is religious? How much of this is just socioeconomic? And I know that's an impossible thing to separate out, but like, I think a lot of people have a tendency to be like, oh, obviously it's Muslim, they're like this. That's why I want to be very
careful,
but also like, I think people have a knee-jerk reaction to blaming it on one thing without appreciating the full depth of what's going on there. So I guess, do you have any thoughts on that?
I have thoughts. I don't think it's religious. It's more cultural. It's not social. It is social, but it's actually cultural tradition. It's all traditions, right? And unfortunately, they haven't gone away. Like the whole world moved on and some units and some groups have stayed on. Let me give you an example. Circumcision, female circumcision and mutilation.
Mutilation.
Yeah. Right? It still exists while the United Nations, they're trying to push hard with human rights. Let's stop that. That's inhumane. That's wrong. It still exists, and it's not. It doesn't just exist in the Middle East. It exists in African countries, right? It's just a tradition, a ritual that's been done for years, you know, from your ancestors, and it just keeps going. It's hard to separate those two. Some females have escaped these things, but that mutilation that's happening, it happens with children. They have no power.
It's, yeah, it's
right.
That's one of the worst things, I think, in the world, that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's like so long term.
And it doesn't even happen with a like a proper doctor, which any real good doctor, medical doctor, would not accept to do this anymore.
That's it, yeah.
It happens in the home. It happens, your mom or your grandma would actually do that to the granddaughter. And babies, it happens with babies.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
horrifying.
So I say this is not religious as much as it's tradition, culture, and it's hard to separate culture.
Yeah,
you know, you know, having moved to New Zealand, Australia, I still see people very attached to the traditions that they've grown up with. It's not the religion as much as you think. It's the way of doing things. It's basically feeling better that you're closer to home by doing these traditions.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's an interesting insight straight away, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
the fact that it's not, yeah.
Look at tradition is a lot stronger, and culture is a lot stronger. I'm a big believer in that. That's why I study consumer culture. Culture, traditions is a lot stronger with people that have migrated, left home, you know, to them more than religion.
Like, and again, it's obviously very hard to separate out those two. Yeah. But I know exactly what you mean. Like, even my parents being Greek, they were both born there and they moved here. So, like, and it's a pretty normal thing. They end up being like more Greek than Greeks back home.
Yeah.
Because they
true.
Like take it with them and then stay there
yes.
while everyone back home has gone and developed and moved on from there. So it's almost like a weird thing. So I know what you mean. And then, like, I guess just thinking that now, because of how quick the culture's changed, obviously, I mean, 100 years ago, the UAE, like all the Gulf states, they probably had nothing compared to now in terms of the money.
That's true. Yeah.
So there's almost an element where they're almost like holding on to cultures as if they've gone to a new country, but they're in their own country. So they're like,
I mean, if you've gone to Dubai today, doesn't look like an Arab country at all, right? It's packed with expats. It has that westernized element. Actually, I would say Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, they've all westernized themselves. And so, yeah, those little strings of, I'm going to wear my abaya. I'm going to wear my, the traditional, customs of, you know, the clothing, the, or I'm going to go to the mosque, you know, just to pray. It's more than just a religion. It's part of who they are.
And almost like, because they've got so much other force coming in, they're holding onto it even tighter.
Yes, that's right. I agree.
That's a complicated thing to unpack.
Yeah.
How do you unwind that?
What I really think should be done is let's understand these different communities, especially if they're moving, migrating. We, you know, most countries are accepting migration, right? And we welcome it from people who are skilled migrants, all these things. Let's try and understand where they come from rather than immediately stereotype, oh, you're Muslim, you're this way. You're Christian, you're this way. You're Jewish, you're that way, you know? Let's try and understand why they are holding on to strong rituals and traditions, right?
Yeah, I think, and that's definitely. But I guess the other side of it is obviously at the same time, you want to change some of them.
True, yes.
Yeah, like,
hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And it's like, to go back to the book now, which, yeah, it's a long series. Actually, just quickly, so did you pick this book because this is your favorite of all of them, or is it like just the most relevant, or just
it's
just
the one I found on the shelf fastest. But look, autobiographies. I love hearing about real stories, real women's stories. And so I've read all her books. And this book specifically, it just really covers the story of the princess, mm-hmm. but it really covers things that I've experienced. And I guess I've seen it. I've seen how life is like, and when I grew up in Kuwait, how women are treated. And I guess it has a lot of relevance to me, to my memories. I can unpack that if you want, but...
Yeah, if you want. I mean,
well, look, there's Kuwait before the war and Kuwait after the war. Mm-hmm. I grew up and I was born...
You were there for the, during...
I was there...
91?
89 and 90.
Okay, right.
So I was there before and out, and we were on holiday right when the war hit, the Gulf War, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. But we came back right away when Kuwait was freed, and Kuwait owed the U.S. for their help. Let's not get into and politics. That's a totally different thing.
I feel like that's the thing. I always feel like all this stuff is so deeply intertwined.
It is
impossible to. So you were there, like as in when. Like, as in, did you see anything? Like-
I had all my friends who were there. It happened in July, August. That's the time when people escape Kuwait because it's really hot, right? Yeah. I had friends who were still there, but we came back right after. And of course, I saw all the bullets. The bulldozers were still there. I saw our home was massacred because you had to come back to take your stuff. And we continued to stay there. My parents are both doctors, so they had to come back as well to support the hospital that they work for and things like that. So, yeah, there is a difference. Kuwaitis were broken after the war. Mm-hmm. A lot of the prisoners that were taken into Iraq were never released, and they were released years later. And so people really felt the pain that their fathers, brothers were taken away from them. And so they became harder. Mm-hmm. Not to say that they're still like that, but I mean, I feel there's a change. There's the country is broken, as in emotionally they're broken when that happened. So whether that impact, and I can't make that correlation either. It's just how I can explain my lived experience. They're rougher and they became rougher and tougher on expatriates that, you know, that moved there and essentially, you know, it became more accentuated how they treated or mistreated women. I don't know if it always existed. I was young back then.
Right.
But as I became 14, 15, you know, you grow up and you walk and you feel like you could be free and you get harassed all the time.
Yeah.
It's just how it is.
And was that, and you're saying that was by the locals or by like
locals.
Everyone?
No, locals.
All right, so not the expat community there. So, and that's, this is why the politics, I feel like it's always important.
Yeah.
Because like and this is my issue with, I think, a lot of people who try to simplify it down to like, oh, this, like religion's usually the excuse. But like a lot of these countries seem to have been hit really hard. And then as a result have almost gone back into their shells and latched onto these, you almost say conservative ideas. It's like how much fault is there? It's more complicated than
it's
saying.
It's way too complicated, but it means that, you know, hopefully the countries themselves are trying to make a change, right? They're trying to educate and give more rights to women. It starts by giving rights, more rights to women. Mm. Now, lucky in Kuwait, women drive.
Yeah, which is not something you should have to be like lucky.
It should. I'm lucky. I can drive. Yay. But again, like Saudi Arabia, only recently women started to be able to drive. And that's what, you know, it's ridiculous that we're still fighting for these things, right? Whether it's in Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, blah, blah, blah. I'm not trying to paint a negative picture.
Well, actually, that's actually, maybe we should stop for a second and be like, because I feel like a lot of people might jump on that conclusion from hearing this and they'd be like, ah, oh, see, it's like, it's backwards everywhere there. But it's like, firstly, there is a difference between different countries in the Gulf, right?
Yeah.
Like as in Oman versus...
Oman is a lot freer, I would say, and a lot more relaxed. Yeah. And they give a lot of rights to women.
I want to point out, firstly, that there is a broad range within the countries within the Gulf.
Yeah.
Obviously, in how they all treat their different rights. But even people who... You can still be for a country even if it's doing something bad, as long as you're... Like, you can acknowledge it. So I think that's an okay thing. And that's and then people get confused because... It's a classic simplicity of everyone. As soon as they hear big issues, they're like, oh, you're totally against it or you're totally for it. And you've probably had that experience yourself personally coming from those states where people are like, oh, so you must hate everything about it, or, oh, you're a self-hating whatever, or the opposite. It's like, oh, you love it and you're defending it. It's like, it contains that complexity.
There's good and bad in every country. Let's not, you know, we live in a beautiful country in Australia. Australia is that. And we have rights and all these things, but people love things and they hate things. It's just natural. Mm. I grew up and I'm very grateful for my life that I had in Kuwait. You know, I loved the school, my education I had, the work experience that I got. I can't, you know, I am who I am because of these experiences. I wouldn't change it for the world, right? There should be changes that happen. We should, you know, go for more rights for women, equality, you know, when it comes to law, the criminal justice system, all these things need to be looked at. I am a human being that have had that experience, and I can say, hand on heart, that there's space. Women are so smart in the Middle East. They are. Because they now everyone has to have an education, right? They may not leave the country. They may leave it and have another education, like coming to RMIT or going to another university, living here, and then going back and giving back. That's important, you know? But let's give women that chance.
Yeah. No, like, and I 100% agree, like, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, no, I disagree with this, actually, Marianne.
How dare you, George?
You really hit a nerve there. No, and I think, like, and this is part of, like, what I find so interesting because like you said, it's the religious and the cultural side is so intertwined in a lot of ways. It's almost hard.
Yeah.
And because of this focus on maybe, for whatever reason, I mean, although every society has had it at some point, treating women as second-class citizens, it's not unique to anyone. And some countries have had it and then lost it and then gotten it again. So it's not even surprising there. But I guess that's what makes it hard because, like, when it's so deeply embedded, it's like, how do you intertwine? You're like, we want to keep the culture. We love everything else about it, but this part here is bad.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it really hard.
It starts from the top. And it also starts from the bottom. It's funny I'm saying that, but really...
It's so broad.
So broad, so everything. No, look, it starts by people going out into the streets, fighting for these rights, okay? We've seen it with things like the Arab Spring from Egypt, for example. People actually making a change and able to bring down a president who's been president for, like, what, 20 years? Hosni Mubarak. And then it starts from the top too. I mean, let's try and make those, let's try and change our legal system. Let's try and change the education system. I mean, in Egypt, for example, there are still books, the curriculum, the Egyptian curriculum, schooling, primary school, still looks at very, you know, basic things about men, women. We don't educate at all. We don't have sex education in Egypt and in all of the Middle East, actually.
Yeah.
And those are things, I'm not saying we should do them, but I'm saying let's make it clear to those men that are deviant in many ways or believe they are dominant, because that's what happens when you segregate men and women in many ways. You don't allow girls to see boys to see girls. You don't give them that space for freedom. You don't, and men don't see their moms working. And again, of course, being a mother is the best job ever. I'm a mom.
Yeah.
But just allowing women to have some rights or all the rights that they should have equal to the men, world will be a better place. I know it sounds like it's a ridiculous thing, yeah, but it really will be, because it just trickles down, and you see men doing deviant things. And it can be very harmful to young girls, to women in the workplace, at home, on the streets. I talk from experience because I've seen it with my own eyes, whether in Egypt or anywhere, any country, Arab country in the Middle East.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they all, to different degrees, right? Because, I mean, I've actually been to Lebanon. That place is chill as.
Yeah, I've been to Lebanon.
Or at least it was.
It is.
I was
there 10 years ago. It still is. It still is.
Yeah, it's so, I don't know if progress is the right word.
It's Franco-Arab.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
call it Franco-Arab because it's more Parisian French kind of thing.
The Paris of the East, right?
Yeah. Look, Egypt, years ago, when my parents grew up in Egypt, it was open. You can wear mini skirts, and I see pictures of my parents, you know, enjoying going out together. You know, nobody's veiled. Obviously, this is something with extremist fundamentalists. Let's not go into religion, because it's not, I don't believe that that's a religious movement.
Well, that's actually, so you're saying that, that's kind of what I was wondering, yeah. Because I've heard that as well. And like, I've actually seen footage of like, I think this is black and white footage of one of the Egyptian prime ministers from like 50 years ago, yeah. 60 years ago, where he's in the cabinet and he's laughing with everyone at the idea of demanding that women wear veils. Like they're actually sharing a laugh because of how progressive they were. Yeah. And then they've gone in the other direction.
So
it's like, obviously that's not a religious thing, because they were the same religion back then. And it's like, so that's where I'm like, yeah, obviously that's a impact of outside forces putting them in a position, maybe similar to how you said in Kuwait, where it's like,
Look, there's a break in the country. That happens in most country, you know, those countries when something happens like this, poverty rises, people are desperate, they want to gain power. It's all these small little things, cracks in society that, you know, encourage such movements. I'm not a historian myself, but the fundamentalists in Egypt, for example, how did they start? It started by people really, everyone's poor, they want control, they're not happy with the president and what he's doing, they're not happy with the agreement with Israel. Let's start our own movement, and it takes off from there, you know? And it just, you gain power, they gained power, and it still exists, and it's become indoctrined. It's not religious, because if we look at religion, it's not like that.
And that's what I mean.
There
that's
are moderate Muslims,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm saying, I think a lot of people have that view without appreciating the full historical context that results in a lot of these places and how they actually are.
Yeah.
To go back to the book, now, before we finish off wildly, so... Okay. Yeah. No, I'm just trying to now think of what I can.
Yeah.
We've done a lot there. It almost feels so small to go back.
I know. We've talked about really. But you know what? The book really encompasses a lot of these things. You know, the book touches on how the boys, the brothers, have more rights than women. It touches on sexual harassment. It touches on incest. It touches on all these things that, to be honest, it doesn't just exist in royal families, but it exists in every, I wouldn't say every family. There are families who are obviously much more educated in the Middle East, in the Gulf region. But it does exist, and we need to be aware of that, and it hasn't gone away, you know?
You know, that definitely, and that sounds, and obviously... I'm not going to make light of all that right now, but it's funny because that actually does make it sound like quite a steamy book. Like quite like as in a
good
read.
It goes into detail.
But like as in a good read.
It's a page turner.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
One of the reviewers said it's a page turner. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Horrific. situation. Yeah. It sounds like a...
But that's why it's a good book to read. Yeah.
Like, it's almost, it's both trashy and informative almost. Like that's what it kind of sounds like.
But just FYI, this book was written and it's about a story from 1994. So it's really dated, of course, but it does, it hasn't gone away. That's the problem. You know, we're talking about something that happened during King Fahd, his kingdom, but it still exists. And it exists in multiple different pockets, not just in Saudi Arabia. It exists in a lot of Arab countries. It's changing. Mm. We do see little bits happening. Like, for example, in Egypt, there are organizations against the mutilation of young girls. Mm. There are organizations helping and supporting women who are raped or assaulted. That never existed. When a woman, when something like this happens to a woman in Egypt, for example, I mention Egypt because I am from Egypt. It's a shame. Women become very ashamed of themselves. Why are you? You did nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know it sounds, well, of course you did nothing, but not back there.
I would say, I would argue that that's actually possibly still coming through here a bit.
Yeah.
Like as in even in Western countries, they're still dealing with this stigma. And you could almost say it's the last 15 years maybe where it's become a bit more, you don't be embarrassed about it, don't be ashamed. And even then it's still not done, I feel like. So
it needs a lot of help, psychological help and support. And even going to a psychiatrist or a psychologist in Egypt is shameful. It's changing. It's changing, but you would never admit to anybody that you're seeing a psychologist.
To go back to the branding thing for a second, this might actually help because of how much, like, obviously the culture now, the rich are like, we all go on a therapist and stuff. So it's like,
it's cool.
Yeah, we gotta be like these guys, right?
Yeah. I mean that is now. There's 10% in Egypt that are the very rich and famous. And you would see them going and I'm cool. I take drugs and I do this and I do that. But that's not the common. If we look at the majority, the other 90% of a huge population, they're suffering.
Yeah. 100%. You know? And that's like across. Yeah. Again, I think people have a tendency to group all the countries, but they're obviously all very different and doing their own things. They're not the same. They're not all the same religion either.
No.
Yeah,
so. I'm Christian.
Yeah.
By the way, you wouldn't have realized that, but I'm Christian and I am a minority in Egypt.
I should have asked that earlier. Imagine, what you religion can't are ask you? That.
I can say it. You can't ask it.
All right. So you brought up, like, your parents are Christian as well?
Yeah, we're Coptic Orthodox Christian.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Orthodox as well.
I know. When you said Greek, I'm like, yeah, he's Orthodox.
We relate. We're the same. Yeah. We both have our delayed Easters.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So that's, do you still do any of that religious stuff?
Of course. You see, with that, I say this is a tradition as much as it's a religion. I would relate more to being Coptic than being Egyptian, for instance. I feel, because it's something that I do all the time. I go to church every Sunday. My kids go to Sunday school. Again, not extremist. We're actually really moderate Christians, but we fast when it's Lent.
I do the fasting.
Yeah, it's embedded in our culture, in my culture.
Yeah. This is actually it's something I've thought about a lot, which is it's almost a shame because it's so embedded, like in the religion and the cultural from everywhere, like even the Greeks, same thing. Managing out the way so that people can still have it without feeling like they're being religious, you know, that whole idea. Like, like, I don't know how to balance that. Well.
I was just talking about that with a co-author of mine because we're trying to do some research on that. And, It is now embarrassing. Well, it's not embarrassing, but you're not secular. You're not open. You're not, thinking about who you are. You're not, all these things. You're too religious. You're too extremist. When I tell people that I'm fasting, sorry, I can't eat that. I'm vegan because I'm fasting for Lent. Oh, I'm given the looks in many ways, you know, but it doesn't mean I'm extremist. It just means, this is part of who I am. I don't want to change that. I'm happy with that.
No, I 100% agree. Yeah. Like, I think it's good. Like, I think fasting is healthy, like to do that now and then.
I do too, you know, and I do it again to feel closer to my roots. They don't have to be related to being Egyptian or to religious. It's just my culture, my community. I do that because I want to, I belong there. Mm. And it's my comfort zone. It's my parents. It reminds me of all the good memories and Easter Sunday and Christmas days, when we're gathered with family. It's connected to all these things. It's not just I do this because I'm a robot and that's how I am, that.
Exactly. And like, I think that's the difficulty in, well, everything we're talking about right now.
I say, if you're questioning something, if you're questioning a religion, read about it and then make your, and go experience it. They always say when you travel to say a country like Egypt, are you traveling as a tourist or do you want to really experience what it's like? And I say the best way to really understand the culture is by living there. It's not just by, knowing the religion, going to the tourist places, going to see the pyramids. It's not. It's really living there, talking, speaking the language, talking to the normal people, even just going to the, going to the suburbs. Rather than the city tourist areas, going to different places that are pockets that are unknown, just finding those out and meeting people. That's why I love, for example, Airbnb. That's why my other research was about Airbnb and the sharing economy. Mm-hmm. And it's all about these experiences. Now, I'm not saying that Airbnb is genuine when they say belong anywhere, but it's actually helpful. In many ways, to really understand the culture.
Yeah, because at least you're like going somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a good point, actually. That's like another plus side to it, the fact that, you're getting deep into the proper kind of place.
Yeah.
Okay, nice thing about Airbnb.
Look, there are obviously negative things, and I try to be objective just simply because, Airbnb really helped a lot of, cities encouraged tourists. I'm talking pre-COVID, of course, but encouraged a lot of people traveling to cities and experiencing and providing small businesses opportunities. And of course, on the other side, it's actually impacted the, hotels and real estate and all these and property and people finding homes to rent because now everyone is actually using rental for Airbnb. Mm. Pros and cons to every business.
It's a classic thing. Everyone's like, it's not one or the other. Yeah. It's like Uber's great, but obviously the mistreatment of workers and the not paying everyone well is bad. So it's like,
exactly.
It's the balancing act. It's like, we're not saying it's bad, but it's like, just because it's good doesn't mean you just let it off with everything else.
Exactly.
That's not how anything
works. These things are democratizing work. They're allowing people to, they're encouraging the gig economy. They're allowing people to work anytime, anywhere, any place, right? Mm. If I'm working on TaskRabbit, I can be working from home, creating designs, helping my income. But on the other hand, it's impacting the actual people who are designers or, doing all these things professionally. Mm. Catch 22.
Yeah. And have you looked into that, done some study on that?
The gig economy. I mean, that is my PhD was on Airbnb and the sharing economy, but I was looking at it from a sense of how do we encourage more sharing than pseudo sharing, which is the fakeness of it all. It's share washing, they call it. And basically using the term share. I'm a business. I'm in the sharing economy. You're just taking the pros of sharing and the real meanings of what sharing is all about, giving community, trust, reciprocity, all these lovely romanticized words, and just using it for a business's advantage.
How do you mean by that? What's an example you can give?
I would say, it could be Airbnb, but it could also be companies that just label themselves, like when you rent bicycles, mm-hmm. for example, or scooters, or all these businesses, Lime, I think it was in New Zealand, and I think it's here too. They say they're part of the sharing economy, but how are you actually sharing? You're not right, really sharing okay. with someone who owns the bike. Like you're not, there is money involved. Yes. You're not having an experience. If we look at the basics of what sharing is all about, it should be you're collaborating on something with someone and having a great experience while you're doing it. That's not sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a business called Lime. They're falling under the sharing economy it's really rental access based rather than sharing, right? Yeah, it's not like collaborative.
We're both using the train. It's a sharing economy.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. And yeah. I guess that the idea is nice, even if, it always ends up getting corporatized and
everything that does happen. Unfortunately, when something becomes really well liked and it becomes a trend and people, they're more attracted to that. And so businesses just jump on the bandwagon, really, and take on the perks of that term without doing the actual work. So that's why it's called pseudo-sharing.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
All right, pseudo-sharing. Nice. Cool. Well, we've jumped around so much.
Yes.
I mean, we did mention the book a few times. So yeah. I feel like we did quite a bit, actually, in a broader sense.
We did. Look, and everything we talked about is the book.
Exactly, yeah. And on top of that, I feel a good pitch as well. It's a steamy, page-turning. I love using the word steamy.
I wouldn't call it steamy.
I saw your reaction the first time. I'm like, I'm going to keep saying
50 Shades of Grey is steamy. This is not steamy.
It's a page-turner.
It's a page-turner.
When did you first read it, like the first one?
I read, I think when... in 99, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you're a bit older, like you were able to take it in. Is it really popular in the Middle East?
It was back then. Actually, if you Google Jean Sasson, she's gone on so many talk shows, Oprah, Fox News. She's talked about the book quite a bit.
Yeah.
And she's gone on interviews with other princesses that escaped and to talk about, what does that mean? So she's quite involved. It's been years.
I mean, just like everything comes in and out of public awareness, this stuff.
And I'm sure there are many books that came out after that, just talking about these life experiences, Maybe it comes back to being a researcher and really my research is all about the lived experience of people. And I think that could be a link. I didn't know I was going to be a researcher back then when I was reading these books, but I've always been intrigued by reality and our lives and what goes on behind closed doors and things like that.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. Well, that's biographies like that would slot perfectly.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I mean, I guess that's it. Cool. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me.
That's right. We jumped a lot of topics.
I'm
it was really
sorry,
fun.
But
that was great. But yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.